Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. When World War II started for the United States with the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, Admiral Bill Halsey had already swung into action. The Patton of the Pacific launched a daring, some might say reckless, naval raids against the Japanese enemy. But it was the Bull Halsey that was lionized in the wartime media. Was it more fiction than fact? We're talking with Tom Hughes. He's the author of the new book, Admiral Bill Halsey, A Naval Life. And Tom, welcome to The Source.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment about Admiral Bill Halsey, World War II fighting in the Pacific Theater, give us a call, 210-614-8980. And, Tom, where was Admiral Halsey on when Pearl Harbor was attacked?
Well, he was at sea returning from a mission to deliver some Marine pilots and planes to Wake Island, and he was probably 200 miles to the southwest of Oahu at the time of the attack, and the senior guy at sea at the moment.
They thought the sneak attack was coming to the Wake Islands.
Well, no, they were. He was delivering some planes out there preparatory to buttressing some of our outward defense perimeter, and he was on his way back after that mission. And was actually due in to Pearl Harbor at about 7 a.m. On December 7th, and bad weather delayed him a couple of hours. His first news of the air attack, he thought, and people on his flagship, the Enterprise, thought that it was jittery American gunners at Pearl Harbor that were firing on an advance echelon of his own planes returning to Pearl Harbor that morning. It was, in fact, of course, the Japanese planes that were attacking that morning.
And so he barely missed the attack, being part of the on the receiving end of the Japanese attack.
Yes, just by about a couple of hours and 200 miles, he was designated the commander at sea that morning, and he and a few other task forces at sea spent a frantic day searching for the Japanese, and they did not find them, much to their chagrin. But in point, in fact, the Japanese task force that morning was much stronger than anything the Americans had at sea, and it was a blessing in disguise, if you will, that Bill Halsey wasn't able to find the Japanese at sea that day, because they would have had a rough go of it. The Japanese were just much more prepared and ready for combat at that point in time.
So Bill Halsey became effectively the leader of the fleet in the Pacific Theater right after the attack.
Essentially on that day, and then through the first 6 months of the war, there was him and a number of other task force commanders with carriers that conducted a series of raids into the Pacific. There were eight of them, and Halsey led four. But Halsey was clearly, in my view, in most people's view, the most successful of those task force commanders in those early raids that stretched from December of 41 up until the Battle of Midway, which in June of 42, which recalibrates the relative weight of the forces there, the Americans and the Japanese, and you go into a different phase of the war. Halsey was the most prominent of these early carrier task force commanders in the war.
So what was Halsey's reaction after Pearl Harbor, other than, you know, this is terrible, this is bad? And did he have any sort of premonition or idea that, you know, we knew war was coming and that they should have been on a more of a footing to deal with that?
Well, they all sort of had a sense that that tension was very high with the Japanese, and that war was coming was probably a likelihood. The weight of evidence and conventional wisdom at the time suggested to American leaders in Pearl Harbor and Washington that the attack would probably come south of Tokyo and Japan and into the Philippine Islands, perhaps, or maybe emanate, if the target was Hawaii, maybe the attack would emanate from the Marshall Islands to the southwest of Hawaii, which was the closest Japanese possession to Pearl Harbor at the time. And that's actually where Halsey directs his search pattern on the morning of December 7th. The Japanese are, in point in fact, approaching from the northwest, his reaction was disbelief, even though they knew it was coming, that it had actually come. He talks in his memoirs about springing into action, but in point in fact, reactions throughout the fleet were pretty sluggish those first few weeks, and it took the Americans a while to find their footing. Halsey's instrumental in helping them find their footing. He probably has, before the war, the clearest sense of any of the carrier commanders of what those early carrier raids would do, these sort of darting and hitting and running attacks on these Japanese outposts in the Pacific War. And it's one of the reasons why he probably is the most successful of the carrier commanders in the first few months of the war.
They were still trying to figure out what to do with these aircraft carriers.
They were. The aircraft carrier was a sort of an invention of the interwar years, and there was great doctrinal debate in the interwar years about how best to use them and how closely to tie them to the traditional battle line, that is, the battleships and the cruisers and a traditional sort of naval battle. And Halsey was one of the men that advocated freeing the aircraft carriers from the traditional battle line and to roam and to do what they do best, these carrier strikes. That was a minority view at the time of Pearl Harbor. It quickly becomes the majority view after most of the battleships of the fleet are laying at the bottom of battleship row. But Halsey has the most experience at his rank level of anybody with carriers, and that's one of the reasons why he's able to sort of develop a concept of operation for them in these early carrier strikes. And it's the first step in the ladder to sort of fame and celebrity for Bill Halsey and the developing sort of notion of the Patent of the Pacific, which you mentioned in your intro, comes from these early months of the war.
And so Halsey realized that the aircraft carrier should be used to bring the attack to the enemy, to attack. But he was also seemed to be an early convert of using air power in the naval, being a naval flyer and aviator and himself.
Yes, he's one of these guys in the interwar years who are known colloquially to history as Johnny Come Latelys into the Naval Air Service. He goes down to Pensacola and learns to fly at 52 years of age in 1934, precisely because there's a law in the United States at the time that commanders of aircraft carriers need to be naval aviators or at least naval observers. They need to be rated in the air service somehow. And the airmen that come up and grow up through the Navy as aviators just don't have the rank yet to command those large ships. And so a few of these men go into aviation very late, and Halsey is one of them. He's in point, in fact, when he gets his wings in 1934, the oldest aviator the Navy ever commissions. And that's when he goes and commands his first aircraft carrier, the Saratoga, in 1934. And for the next 6 years, sort of learns and acculturates to naval aviation, in my view, better than any other senior naval officer in the service, and that leads him well poised on December 7th, 1941, to become the kind of commander he is once aircraft carriers are about the only game in town.
Did he really cheat on his eye exam?
Well, I don't know if he cheated. He just never passed it, and through a series of sort of bureaucratic maneuverings, he's able to get his naval aviator wings.
Through a rigged physical. Okay, we're going to continue the conversation. We're going to talk more about Admiral Bill Halsey. We'll get into his temperament and some of the things that he said about the enemy. What was that about? This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Admiral Bill Halsey was one of the most famous naval officers of World War II, is known as Fearless, and launched a series of raids early in the war against the Japanese. He brought some needed good news to people in the United States who were watching the war and uncertain about the outcome. We read about Admiral Bill Halsey, A Naval Life, the new book from Harvard University Press by Tom Hughes. Tom, so Bill Halsey was also a much bigger than life type of a character, almost out of central casting.
Yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is to develop some humanity back into that flesh and blood human being. Their war makes him a celebrity and a legend, and in the process of becoming larger than life, he becomes less of a man almost. And he was all that history accords. He was big, he was bold, he was audacious, But he was. But these were more professional skills and not personality traits. He was quite reticent in a lot of his interpersonal relationships and quite cautious in his command of anything other than carriers at sea in the South Pacific. He has an entire area force, and he has ground forces and Marines in his control, and he's quite cautious at some points in their employment. And I wanted to sort of build that nuance back into the picture of Bill Halsey and get away from the Bull Halsey of history and try to recover a little bit of the Bill Halsey of the time and the place. And that was one of my central goals in writing the book.
I remember seeing a Time magazine cover, I think it's from 1942 or 43, has him on the cover, Bill Halsey, and underneath it, it says, kill Japs, kill Japs, kill more Japs. He said a lot of things that today would be considered racist. And to me, you can look at him in wartime and his language that he used, and you could do a study about the use of racial language in wartime.
Yeah, he becomes sort of a poster child for some of this racial invective that that all sides during the war in the Pacific War had. The Japanese certainly display some of the same characteristics, but the Americans do too. And that's a
I mean,
product,
it is it happens in war. It's that you dehumanize your enemy. It is part of war.
Yep. Yes, once the mass killing of other human beings becomes state policy, as people, you've got to cope with that somehow, and enmity is how we cope with that, it seems to me. You develop a hatred, and you have a hatred for the other side because you've got to get through the day as you're trying to kill them. And that's what Halsey is trying to do in the South Pacific. And he says to our ear today in 2016, just incredibly outrageous things. And that's a fair enough statement, absolutely.
And then after the war, he became a symbol of trying to have a reconciliation for that type of talk.
One of the most amazing things I discovered with Bill Halsey is that after the war, he develops a very warm relationship with lots of Japanese, and his enmity is really sort of temporal in time and place to the war. His wartime outlook is racist, and his voice is racially tinged. But after the war, he even writes a letter to another friend saying, boy, I've just lost all hatred of these people. And he comes to a place of amity, if I almost will suggest, with the Japanese. His enmity is temporal. His wartime views are racist, but they fade with time. Yep.
And so do you think that is part of his legacy?
Well, it's part of the legacy I would like to build into him. It's not part of the traditional sort of legacy that we have of him, which remains fairly fixed in the literature from the time of the war itself. He becomes sort of the marble man of the Pacific, and his visage hasn't changed much in 75 years. And one of the things I am trying to do is acknowledge that visage and the reality of it and the authenticity of it during the war, but also say that it's almost a caricature where you can see a broad truth evident enough, but where almost every detail is incorrect. And I'm trying to sort of correct some of that. There's a human being there that's trying to cope with this national emergency as well as he can. But he comes back home to being a human being after the war. And one of the legacies I would like to build into him is just that he was more than Bull Halsey. He was also Bill Halsey.
Let's go to the callers, 210-614-8980, if you want to join our conversation as we talk with Tom Hughes about his new book, Admiral Bill Halsey, A Naval Life. And Claiborne is on the line. Claiborne, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. As far as Admiral Halsey and kill Japs, kill more Japs, and all of that, in the context of the time, especially because he was a Anglo who made it to flag rank, and I presume was a Naval Academy graduate, I mean, in the context of the time, that was standard. What his type would have referred to black folks or Tejanos or, you know, anybody that wasn't white I mean, in the context of the time, that was normal. Not to mention all, I mean, let's think about all of the headlines, Japs attack Pearl Harbor. In context, it was normal for the time. And as far as, I mean, his job as a commander, well, your job as a soldier, but especially if you are a commander, is to find the enemy, start kicking them in the balls or the ovaries, and attack, attack, attack until you destroy them.
Sure.
That's the job.
All right. So, Claiborne, just to be clear, I wasn't trying to, you know, I know that he's a product of his time and he had a certain role to play, and that's what we were alluding to. And then we were talking about his journey to less of that. So, but thank you for your call, and we'll see what Tom Hughes has to say about that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. He sees his role as marshaling his forces against an enemy of the state as best he can, and he's very conscious when he first goes to the South Pacific, when he starts using a lot of this language in late 1942, that the American forces are at a nadir, both materially and spiritually and psychologically, if you will, and he's trying to rally his forces. And his language is used that way very consciously. And it is his job, it is his duty to marshal his forces to fight as best he can the Japanese forces in the region. And so he's very much a product of his time and place. He comes to us as famous because of his positions, but his views would not have been out of the ordinary at the time. He had more press and ink about it, but lots of people thought the way he thought. Lots of people thought the way he thought.
But he was the poster child. They made billboards with some of the things that he said that were inflammatory,
yep,
against the Japanese. And because, absolutely, they came from Admiral Halsey, I mean, he was the epitome. He the guy who was almost fictionally created by the media at the time as this strong, desperate person who is going to just fight and for America out in these terrible conditions and beat the Japanese to we have that unconditional surrender.
Yeah, and his hatred at the time is visceral and it's real, and it's very common at the time. It's you see it even in relatively urbane commentary, the New York Times or The Nation, the periodical review, Life magazine runs a large picture of a very attractive woman with a Japanese skull that was sent to her by her fiancé, and it's a human interest photo in Life magazine. And in the Japanese press at the time, you can see the same caricaturizations of the white Anglos that they're fighting. This is a product of enmity in wartime that we were talking about a little bit earlier.
Sure, and we're just trying to take an analytical look at how things were at that time.
Sure, yep.
So, and Hugh is on the line. Let's get Hugh in a conversation. Hugh, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, ask the author about the code clerk mistake that occurred in the battle off the Philippines that caused enmity between Halsey and Nimitz for years.
Okay, Hugh, you just asked it, so let's hear what the response is.
Yeah, in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, Bill Halsey is the Third Fleet commander at sea, and he chases what is arguably, and I think rightfully, often understood as a decoy force into the north. The Japanese want to draw Halsey's powerful aircraft carrier force away from the landing area that they want to attack, and Nimitz sends a message from Hawaii asking where is Task Force 34, which is Halsey's task force, and there's a code message on the back end of that question, the world wonders. So the message that reaches Halsey's flagship, and Halsey is, where is Task Force 34, the world wonders. Well, the world wonders is actually a part of a coding message to sort of complicate the decoding of that message by the Japanese, and it wasn't really part of Nimitz's question, but Halsey sees it as part of Nimitz's question and finds it as a kind of a personal insult to him from his old friend Chester Nimitz, who he knew for 40 years, way back to their time as the Naval Academy students. And he reacts very emotionally to that, and it probably clouds Halsey's judgments a little bit. He turns his fleet around and rushes back to the shores of Leyte Gulf, which in essence maroons his force in that battle. He's not able to complete the destruction of the decoy force to the north, and he arrives back south too late to do anything about the battle there. And his great, massive, powerful fleet is becalmed, and it's probably his greatest controversial decision during the war. And whether it was a mistake or not, or whose fault it was, has become one of the great indoor sports in the historiography of the war. And I think that's what the caller is referring to.
And how bad did that damage his reputation? Because he's known as a brave, daring, but reckless admiral. We're real short on time.
Well, it's central to his reputation. That mistake at Leyte Gulf is central to his reputation, and his running into two typhoons late in the war is central to this reckless reputation. So I would say,
yeah. Very, so you have to look at the man as a whole, and his when he won, and when his blunders, and also him away from service. And always in service, as he was, as always in the Navy, a naval life. Admiral Bill Halsey is the book. The author is Thomas Hughes. Thank you for joining us. This is The Source on KSTX.